Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined once again today by Joshua Blank, the research director for the Texas Politics Project. Top of the busy morning.
Oh, yeah. Is it the top?
Yeah, well, towards the end, it's, you know, yeah.
I wish.
It's after morning, good after morning. So we're recording here on Thursday, what's the 9th, right?
Yep, the 9th of October.
You know, about 11 o'clock in case, you know, things happen in the next few hours before this podcast comes out, which I wouldn't, you know, doesn't seem likely. So a lot going on. One of those days I thought we'd hit three things. We'll spend most of our time on the middle, you know, the meat of the sandwich here. But we talked quite a bit last week about the public opinion context in Texas of the government shutdown, which is obviously dominating domestic news. And just want to check in on that since we talked about it so much. And then a couple of Texas-linked stories that are really breaking through nationally. I think most prominently in the, you know, the meat and cheese of this sandwich, the deployment of Texas National Guard troops to Illinois and possibly elsewhere while this is being litigated in the courts, and Governor Greg Abbott's, I would say, robust willingness to do this.
Yeah.
And then also just a, you know, a couple of days old now, but worth mentioning our podcast, a new entrant, not a big surprise entrant in the Republican primary race for the U.S. Senate. You know, we'll, if you haven't heard, then we'll make it a surprise, but I'm sure you know what we're talking about. So, you know, let's get right to it. Start with a quick check-in. So last week, as I said, we looked at some of the Texas data that conveyed some context for the politics of the shutdown, which, you know, I think, I don't know how I would, you know, that part of the point of last week was a little bit hard to generalize out of that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, I think that's right. I mean, there's no generalization necessarily to make. I mean, part of it is this is, you know, an intense political fight that's, you know, trying to, like, obviously, as we're going over last week, is trying to pick up and, you know, pick on particular currents in the electorate, you know, from both parties.
On both sides,
on both sides. But the whole point I think we were trying to make here is, you know, I think this is important, you know, for most Americans who won are not picking up on the, like, the fine grained, you know,
subtleties,
currents and subtleties that are going on here. For most of them, this is just sort of a, you know, to say it's a disruptive event on the economy in a moment in which people are concerned still and remain concerned about the economy. And so that doesn't say anything about, like, you know, who they're going to blame or how they're going to allot it or any of that kind of stuff, or which argument is going to win or not. But it does sort of raise this issue, which is, you know, sometimes I think from our perspective, or at least my perspective, I won't speak for you, but sometimes some of these messages, when you think, well, is this likely to land? Is this likely to push the needle? Do we think this sort of meets the way that people are thinking about this? I think the point, at least, you know, I was trying to make, and I think you too at that point, was, yeah, for a lot of people, the context they're going to receive this in is not going to necessarily be sort of the partisan beds that, you know, we're kind of used to laying. And it's going to be, well, wait a minute. So when, you know, does this, if this ripples through the economy, that's going to meet a much more salient story for people than sort of, I think, some of these other questions about, well, you know, but we're trying to, you know, rein in spending, or, you know, this is not the proper, like, process or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those issues where, you know, partisanship is clearly out there, but it's not really showing up in the numbers. So, you know, we don't have to do a lot more on this, but, you know, YouGov-CBS released a poll that was in the field October 1st to the 3rd, so the first 3 days of the shutdown. That's another thing about this is that it's a pretty fluid, sorry for the academic, it's a fluid discursive and political environment, right? You know, the language is shifting, the emphases are shifting. Democrats and Republicans are figuring, you know, they're doing polling and looking at public opinion polling.
And it's taking place in the context of, obviously, one of the more active, you know, participants in politics ever in Donald Trump, who's also constantly sort of testing and trying new efforts. I mean, sort of like, you know, again, since you've already raised social sciences, it's almost like there's so many things going on at once to pick out one and say, well, this is going to move.
Right.
It's impossible. There's just too much noise
and, you know,
in the
lines
right now.
Political actors are going to make bets. And,
yeah.
You know, so I think, you know, the YouGov polling yesterday had, you know, nobody really seeming to have a particularly clear advantage. I mean, reflecting your, you know, mention of Trump, you know, they asked just a straight, you know, do you approve or disapprove of how each of these, you know, actors or group of actors are handling the shutdown? You know, the approval numbers were low. Trump was at 32 approve, 52 disapprove. Congressional Republicans at 28 approve, 52 disapprove. Congressional Democrats, 27, 49. And so, you know, nobody's really, people aren't like standing up and going, yeah, go our guys. If we break that down, you know, there's partisan structure in there, but not, you know, but it's still, you know, overall, it's a pretty negative negative experience.
But I think those numbers reinforce what we're talking about here in really important way, right? Which is to say, you know, the fact that you see about I think, you know, in some ways, an approval number over a shutdown is kind of a weird thing to ask in some sense. In some sense, you're saying, how much do you approve of the way that each of these actors has contributed to the failure of this bad thing? But what you note is you have about a little less than a third who are willing to approve of the work the Democrats are doing in Congress.
Right.
So presumably these are partisan Democrats who are happy for those Democrats to take a stand.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have about a third of voters who say that they're happy with the way Trump's analysts, congressional Republicans. Again, those are not the same voters. They're most likely committed Republicans who think they should stay in the line.
Right.
Democrats are the minority. They should, you know, go to hell, whatever. But the point is that if you take those two, and again, you can't really do this, but I think you could if you did the math, you'd say it's about 60%, which means about 40% of people who are just like, no. Who probably say like no to most of this, or just like who disapprove of everybody. And that's, I think, one of the important points here, which is a lot of the messaging right now is really geared towards the committed people on both sides.
Yeah.
And the question is, and what we're waiting for is once it starts to bleed out further beyond the partisan bases, then what happens? And right now, this is the first 3 days, this is kind of what we wait to see.
Well, and we've talked a lot about, you know, the partisanship and anxieties about the economy and, you know, I mean, there's a real question here, I think, about how much our expected dynamic of, you know, public opinion being led by elite queuing on a partisan basis is going to prove resistant to that. Because when we look at those kinds of measures, and we did this a couple weeks ago when we talked about the economy, you know, just separate largely, you know, the farther away you get from these macro level play of partisanship, the less partisanship matters and the more the actual economic experiences that people are having matter. And, you know, that showed up in another item in the YouGov poll. You know, they asked, you know, how concerned are you about the government shutdown's effect on the economy? Nearly half, effectively half, 49%, very concerned, 31%, somewhat concerned, and only 20% not concerned. And that's a real, you know, that's a minefield here for both parties. But I think you have to say that is the incumbent party going into a midterm election, that's a little bit more of a problem for Republicans than it is for Democrats.
That's right.
You know, I think.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's sort of, you know, that's one of the big questions. I mean, we kind of get to that in the discussion point. I mean, I think, you know, just before we get there, we should let one other piece of this, which is, you know, as it is really early and we are waiting to see how this plays out with a little bit more time, right? I mean, there's some indication that the health, you know, care issue is breaking Dems way a little bit in the short run. I mean, I think Trump's sort of indicating we're going to find this WIC money over here, says that, you know, they must know something about that is a problem if they're going to, you know, dip into that. But, you know, the other point here is there's going to be some other pressure points that are going to build up over time here, right? So this Friday, federal employees are going to get their last paycheck and it's going to be partial.
Yeah.
You know, For military personnel, the first missed payday is going to be October 15th. So federal employees are going to miss their first full paycheck on October 24th. And the federal government is a huge, huge employer. So like the idea that this isn't going to have some ripple effects on spending and some other things that are already a little, you know, dicey is it's a wait and see game at this point.
Yeah. And the last 24 hours have seen, you know, maneuvering on the Republican side, you know, on the point of the military paycheck to try to figure out some way, and there are two different ways in play in the two different chambers to, you know, unfreeze the military paychecks. I mean, last I read, the House was kind of discussing some kind of a separate, just standalone, we're just going to release some money for these guys. Interestingly, given what we've been talking about to our class this week in terms of institutions on the Senate side, Dune seems to be trying to actually move the military appropriations bill that's already been passed in the House, and to try to, you know, begin to like eat away at the shutdown. Kind of, you know, the image you get is one appropriations bill at a time. We have to go into how, whether that's a reasonable long-term strategy. but it is a way of shifting the focus away from this, what the Democrats want to be talking
about.
Well,
yeah, and it does it in a way that really is going to put Democrats in a serious bind.
Yeah.
Because ultimately the idea of, you know, let's say, first of all, so you're not going to fund the troops. And the Democrats say, well, yeah, look, that's not the point. You say, but it is, you don't want to fund the troops. And then they're going to, and someone is going to say,
yeah,
some Democrat somewhere, because of the fact there's no leadership in the party and it's totally disaggregated, someone is going to say, you want us to, I mean, we'll get to the next story later, but you want us to fund the military that the president wants to deploy to, like, Democratic cities, per his words?
Yeah.
You're putting them in a tough spot there. I mean, you
yeah.
know, I think.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, I suspect no Democrat in a leadership position will say that,
no,
but yes.
But it's tricky. Exactly.
And whether it's a Democratic member or just, you know, I mean, it's probably already on
right.
social media.
Exactly.
So, you know, we'll keep tracking this and, you know, I'd like to think this, we won't have to talk about it. Maybe next week we can be talking about the resolution, but I don't think so. Now, you gave us a good transition. Texas is in the national news for a couple of other things this week. One pretty big and fundamental in some ways, as you were kind of saying the other day in a different context, you know, doesn't get much bigger than the issue of the president kind of deploying military forces and mobilizing the National Guard to send from one state to another. Pretty big. Yeah, they're a bit, little more insidery. So let's start with the deployment of the National Guard. So, you know, Greg Abbott has enthusiastically agreed to President Trump's deployment of Texas National Guard troops to Illinois. They're already there. They got there, I think, yesterday morning, Wednesday morning, maybe even before that. I think maybe even Tuesday. They got there pretty quick. I mean, there wasn't a lot of waiting around, and I think part of that, you know, I think there was an initial attempt to block it in court. That attempt didn't work. While that was going on, they sent them.
There's an advantage to speed here because the courts don't move quickly.
Right. And so they just sent them and they're there. And morning news this morning is that there were Texas National Guard sighted around one of the federal buildings, you know, almost certainly the immigration enforcement facility there. And, you know, again, sent with the ostensible legal purpose, presumably of defending federal facilities or at least more legally defensible.
Yeah.
But also under the rhetoric that we've seen behind these deployments, the other sort of horn of that, which is just sort of the political purpose of fighting crime because crime rates are high in Chicago, et cetera. And Chicago's been one of the Trump administration's poster children for fighting, you know, urban crime in America using the military and the National Guard and pillaring local and state authorities for ostensibly doing nothing about this. And Trump's been talking about sending troops to Chicago for a long time.
Yeah.
It's obviously something that is
in
his mind. It's
yeah.
in there. And, you know, the governor of Texas has been very quick to respond to this and to help. And story this morning, I think it posted early this morning, maybe late last night by David, I guess it was late last night,
yeah.
by David Goodman, the Southwest correspondent for the New York Times, about, you know, the offshoot tension here
yeah.
within the collective, the National Governors Association, because, you know, Governor Abbott of Texas and Governor Pritzker of Illinois are, you know, taking the gloves off on social media, such as it is, and in their public pronouncements, and it's brought to the surface something that's been bubbling under, and that is this fight within the governors' associations. You know, that seems pegged again. We've talked a lot about norms and history and how these things are changing
yeah.
to the traditional role of the National Governors Association on a bipartisan basis, more or less.
Yeah,
to defend the prerogatives of the states and the states' leaderships, which, you know, stands to reason, and how this seems to be possibly a watershed in that kind of, you know, breaking up. People, you know, some of the Democrats are talking about, I mean, Gretchen Whitmer, I think, has already left the—
Yeah, a couple of them already left.
Yeah, the National Governors Association, some others
well,
either are talking about it. So, you know, there's a lot of dimensions to this. But the Texas dimension is kind of pretty interesting, right?
I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of unimaginable. I mean, it's not unimaginable, but it's not actually that hard to imagine the strength of the response we would expect here in Texas.
Yeah.
Were a Democratic president to mobilize the National Guard of California or New York and try to send them into the state. Like, I'm not sure that our National Guard would not be counter-mobilized to keep them from doing whatever they were supposed to do, whatever that looked like. I mean, I don't know how far Abbott could go to go too far in responding to something like that. I mean, to your point, I mean, you know, you're talking about like sort of, I mean, like this, as you've, we've talked about before, you've been teaching this class for, you know, we've been teaching a class in Intro to American Government. So, you know, we've gone back, we've been going over a lot of stuff. And it is just sort of like, if you go back to kind of, and this is like, you know, whatever you can say, who cares, but you go back to the founding of the Republic and like what they were doing.
Yeah.
The idea in any way, shape or form that the federal government in any guise under the president, the Congress, whatever, would just take control of state militias, which they definitely did not want you to do.
Yeah.
And then mobilize them to go do things in other states is like literally like the whole republic would have fallen apart in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like, I mean.
Well, and, you know, even more recently, you know, in a Texas focus, if we look at, you know, the animated, you know, the animating energy around Reconstruction and the reassertion of, you know, what was then, you know, essentially conservative democratic rule in the state as part of the deal to end Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. I mean, a big part of that deal was getting federal troops out of Texas.
Yeah. And
right?
I mean,
so there's a, you know, I mean, and look, I there are people out there who's like, oh, it was more subtle than that. And yes. But broadly speaking, I would defend the position. This is a very different look than we've seen in terms of the prevailing norms and kind of the majority, I wouldn't even call it ideology, the majority sensibility among Texas politicians about the relationship between Texas and the federal government.
And between states and the federal government generally.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing here, right?
So.
So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's like, it doesn't seem like this was a really hard decision for Abbott, you know, despite all this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think Greg Abbott had to think about this very long.
No.
Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't see it coming. I don't want to naive.
Well, there's two different things, right? I mean, one, you say he didn't seem to have to think about it for very long, but it, but the context is also interesting, right? I mean, he has no challenge in his bid, right? No serious challenge in his bid for governor for his fourth GOP nomination, right? He's got $80 million in his campaign account. I mean, had he paused, had he waited, had he considered it, it wasn't as though, like, you know, I think he would have been seriously threatened, you know, from somebody because of that. Like, I mean, he certainly has the back, you know, so the background, the history to say, yeah, this is not really how we see this thing playing out. I mean, and I'll say, you know, this is sort of getting into a little bit of the discussion. I mean, somebody kind of said, in the Goodman piece, actually, you know, considering, you know, Abbott's presidential aspirations, we've always really played down in this podcast pretty aggressively. I will say, this is the one thing that I've seen that for no particular reason, I thought to myself, it seems more plausible now than it's seemed to me in other instances, just because it is, it is such a public statement at a national level in a way that he's been, you know, Abbott's been very comfortable stepping into and has done in good ways, usually to his benefit. That's what I mean by good ways. Yeah. This is like, it feels like a bigger step, you know, it feels like a bigger thing to me. I mean, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't turn out to be.
Yeah.
But it's also like, you know, the idea that, like, you know, what if a Texas National Guard gets in a conflict with an Illinois citizen in Illinois?
Yeah.
There's just a lot of weird stuff here that, like, you know, we're just going to kind of have to figure out. And I mean, you know, even though, and I'll just sort of bring in some public opinion here. I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, even though Abbott's in a strong position here, sort of.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just to sort of put this in sort of context, right? So if we look at his job approval numbers, you know, they've declined in recent months. You know, we kind of, I would sort of say, you know, the special session's probably not helping. I think he really polarized views, you know, in a lot of sense. I think Republicans are happy enough, which we'll get to. Democrats are significantly less so. But, you know, less than a year ago in December of 2024, in our polling, the governor had a net approval rating of plus 21. So that was how much higher his approval rating was than his disapproval. Since then, his net approval has declined to plus 11 in February, plus 1 in April, minus 4 in June, and minus 10 in August.
Right.
So
just near the bottom of
his
where he's been historically.
And I mean, and look, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. There's, you know, obviously everything has a million, everything's complicated, but it's hard not to see his increasing national presence, his increasing closeness to the president has contributing to a lot of that, especially his decline among Democrats for sure and independents here.
Right.
Now, among Republicans.
But he's also dropped a little among Republicans.
He's also dropped a little bit among Republicans.
But just a little.
Yeah. From 83% approval down to still lower, but, you know, respectable 76%. So, you know, no red alert here, right? And I don't think, you know, there was, as we said, there's probably not a lot of debate about, acceding to the president's request and maybe even enthusiastically. And because, look, Donald Trump still is the leader of the party here, but with no question, right?
Right.
I mean, among Texas Republicans, his numbers have dropped, but from 92% to 85%, which is still 9 points higher than Abbott.
Right. Among Republicans.
Among Republicans.
Yeah. So, you know, the outcome, pack your gear, you're going to the Windy City,
yeah.
Guardsmen. And so, I mean, I think that's not, you know, I mean, I don't want to go far too down the rabbit hole of the Abbott presidential thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You know, well, no, I had it kind of in my head to comment on it, but probably differently in that,
yeah.
You know, I just feel like national reporters cannot help
yeah.
but include that, and they are playing directly into,
yeah.
you know, into the hands of Greg Abbott and, you know, in the story, the unnamed political consultant
yeah, uh-huh.
who mentioned to David, you know, probably just you know, essentially a setup. I mean, if he could have mentioned the name, he would have,
yeah.
you know, he could have slipped and gone and Dave said, but, you
yeah.
know, I'm not informed. You know, he said, oh, you know, Governor Abbott is focused on the gubernatorial election right
yeah.
now, and that's all we got to say about it. And that's been the Abbott play
yeah.
all along. Do nothing to dissuade the talk, particularly at the state level, and when it pops up in the national press of him as, you know, somebody who should be considered as a possible presidential candidate. But we've not seen the trigger pulled on that.
Yeah.
And we should remind, you know, I mean, most of our listeners will know that $80 million he's got in the bank is not transferable
right.
to a national campaign.
Boom.
It shows he can raise money, but
it's not under
a very different regime at the federal fundraising level,
yeah.
et cetera. And, you know, in a crowded field, I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, and this does not differentiate the governor from the other pro-MAGA, whatever you want to call them, candidates that will be much more positioned than him at the national level. So I just, you know,
yeah,
nothing wrong with mentioning that. I mean, it's not empirically correct to say, oh, he's been mentioned, but to my mind, it kind of misses the context.
Do you know what I would just add to that? I mean, I think it's a good, I mean, you're making a good point, and I would say, you know, one of the things I think people probably fail to sufficiently appreciate is that as the governor of a state as large as Texas, he's always in the conversation. I mean,
yeah.
like anything that the state does is going to generate a ripple effect that sort of just automatically elevates you in the way that, you know, the governor of Rhode Island is not going to be elevated.
And in most situations he and those around him have zero incentive to in any way tamp down that kind of discussion. So now in a different public opinion context, you know, Greg Abbott has benefited in the recent past, and this is in the direction of unpacking why this was kind of an easy decision, I think. The most obvious part, we could stop if we wanted with the Trump numbers, frankly.
Yeah.
But there's more. I mean, the governor's benefited in the recent past from, you know, poking the eyes of state urban Democrats on national crime and on immigration. You know, there in the past, this is kind of the intersection of crime and immigration enforcement, but it is a callback to the governor's big political win with busing migrants out of state during the Biden administration. I mean, I'm, you know, thinking back to the profile of Governor Abbott that was done in The New Yorker and, you know, other kind of the other national press, you know, where the consensus is Greg Abbott really did himself some good, did the president some good, did the Republicans some good by engaging in what initially seemed like kind of a funky maneuver to pay to bus migrants on the border to other states and seemed a little tricky, you know, trick pony-ish, as a friend of mine would say. But it actually really built his stature nationally, and it was very – but to our other point about the two games here, it was also very popular among his base in Texas at that time. I mean, we did multiple polls in 2023 and 2024, and this was going on. More than 80% of Texas Republican voters approved of Abbott's efforts to bus migrants out of state. And that was even when the question explicitly mentioned in you know, the interest of balance on our part and that Texas was paying for the busing. It's like, yeah, we'll pay for that.
Well, not only that, I mean, it was surprisingly popular, not overwhelmingly, but it was popular among a significant share of Democrats. It was popular among independents. So, I mean, you know,
that was that period, right, where Democratic anxiety about immigration and, you know, because of the border was rising.
Yeah, because of the crossing. Yeah, because of the number of crossings. And I think, you know, I mean, what I sort of noticed in the immediate aftermath of the deployment, and it sort of perfect kind of dovetails on these discussions, is, you know, you get these governors from out of Texas, now Pritzker in this case, pushing back on Abbott, saying, you know, what are you doing? And Abbott says, basically, hey, look, you're just running for president. You should defend your cities.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, when you get your stuff under control, call me. Which basically, again, please.
It's a lot of cake to have and eat in that.
Yeah, no, and it's a perfect. But it's also, again, it's the perfect kind of response to this thing, because ultimately the issue here is, and it's like a lot of these sorts of issues, I mean, sort of a meta thing that we're not going to talk about this moment, but it's like, when will we, the collective we, whoever that is and counts in that, be satisfied that the federal buildings in Illinois are safe enough as is?
Yeah.
And that's just like, so there's no response here. You know, I mean, it's just sort of like, you're just kind of left with, well, you know, name calling, which is what we're kind of seeing.
While all of this thrashing is going on, or I shouldn't say thrashing, there's some thrashing in this debate. And, you know, we should say that, you know, there are two court, you know, there are hearings today, probably happening as we speak on, you know, requests for, I think they're asking for a TRO on the Abbott deployment to Chicago. There's also another sort of hearing going on the deployment to Portland, which I think the governor has also offered troops to send to Portland as well, as based on what I'm read.
Right.
And so, you know, that's all being sort of thrashed out right now anyway, but that means that no matter what happens, that you're still going to have some form of federal deployment in anywhere from 3 to 5 American cities. And if we just full stop for a second, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, it's – no, I mean, like, I try – like, I'm not
– As we started, I mean
– Yeah, and I'm not – you know, I would say I'm probably one of the least – you know, I'm pretty – I don't know. I would say I'm not hyperbolic about a lot of this. Yeah. If anything, I'm sometimes concerned that I'm a little bit
under-concerned,
under-alarmed. I'm under-alarmed about a lot of things probably, and that's kind of by nature. But I will say, you know, I mean, this to me is like one of the most important issues I've ever seen. I think, you know, the idea right now that like the deployment of, you know, troops to American cities in peacetime, straight up. I mean, like—
That's what looking at all that institution stuff for intro government does for you, man.
Well, I just, you know, I mean, I went back and I'm reading all this stuff. Like, what were they really concerned about? It's like this. This is what they were concerned about. This is what the limitations that were placed on the executive branch, on the federal government. Like, this was the control over the militias was why we almost lost the Revolutionary War, because the states didn't want to give them up.
Yeah.
Because the states were unwilling to send these troops out of their states to go do stuff. So, like, this is not like, I mean, I'll say, like, it's strange. Like, a lot of stuff is really abstract in terms of, like, the historical discussion. This is not abstract at all. Like, this is a complete departure from what, you know, we're supposed to expect. So it is, like, a really big story. But it is like, I mean, as a public opinion scholar, and we say it's like, so does this just get filtered through partisanship? Does it matter that the state and actually Republican voters in the state have not too long ago expressed significant concern about these kinds of activities?
Well, right. I mean, look, one doesn't have to look very far, you know, to see the arguments that we were kind of putting out there earlier, the observations that, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot and a Democratic president was sending out state National Guard troops from another state to Texas to pursue a policy opposed by the state's leadership, you know, that would likely not be going over very well. Now, we don't have an exact test for this in terms of public opinion, but we do have an interesting, I don't know, it's not quite a parallel, but it's, you know, the two of the axes of a parallelogram of some sort, or, you know, or a trapezoid. But, you know, without torturing my geometry here, you know, we can go back to some polling that we did during Operation Jade Helm, which many of you will remember back in 2015. And at that point, the governor ordered the Texas State Guard to monitor, quote unquote, the U.S. military training exercises that were being staged in Texas. And they wanted to make sure that there were, you know, and the guard was instructed to make sure that there were no violations of Texas sovereignty, Texans' rights. And, you know, we have a blog piece that I'll dig out and link back to those items. You can find it at texaspolitics.utexas.edu when we create a post for this particular podcast if you're listening on another platform. But at that time, you know, we asked Texas voters about this, right?
Right. We asked them, you know, do you support, first of all, deploying the Texas State Guard to sort of monitor the U.S. military? Because in some sense, I mean, first, just as a set piece here, the U.S. military is the most favorably viewed institution of any institution that we could ask Texans about. So it's not as though Texans have a negative view of the U.S. military or even, I mean, honestly, full stop.
Right.
Texans do not have a negative view of the U.S. military. They are the most highly rated institution in America currently, and they've been that way for a while. Nonetheless, when we asked this question, do you support sending the State Guard to monitor the U.S. military? 39% supported it, 28% opposed it, and about a third just didn't have an opinion, which makes sense. But obviously, you know, you know this, most of the support came from Republicans. 57% of Republicans, a majority, supported it. And among the most conservative Texans who are really driving a lot of these conversations, nearly three quarters, 74%, supported monitoring, along with 81% of strong Republicans. So if you say among the most partisan, the most conservative, there was a lot. Now, why did they want this? 55% of Republicans thought it was very or somewhat likely that the federal government was going to order the U.S. military to impose martial law. This also includes, I want to say, 32% of Democrats and 41% of independents. So this idea, first of all, that the military is going to come in is not like totally new or, you know.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
And just to put a pin on that and connect it with, you know, where we've been already. I mean, that's why this is kind of remarkable, right?
Yeah.
Because we're not talking about, you know, a very narrow partisan view of aggressive state sovereignty or state rights. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a relatively broad-based impulse in the state that I would say is deeply historically rooted.
Yeah.
You know, when you've got a third of Democrats going, yeah, you know, the U.S. military might impose martial law. I mean, that's telling you something not just about the surface politics, although it can tell us things about that, but also the substrate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, this is one of those instances. I mean, that's a good, really, really good point. It's one of those instances where when we talk about these principles of like the U.S. government that we think are like kind of like fundamental, like this is part of the limited government and sort of just skepticism towards government power writ large that even a larger Democrat told. In that same polling, nearly two-thirds of Republicans, 63%, said it was very or somewhat likely that the U.S. military would arrest political protesters. 52% of independents agreed. So did 38% of Democrats. Now, this was, of course, during the Obama administration. No doubt these numbers are going to look, you know, different now. But they're still really – I mean, I say they're informative of what makes – I'm going to say this, you know, they're not necessarily informative of what we're going to see when we ask, you know, maybe similar questions in the future. But they're informative of, like, why this situation seems so at odds with what we understand the political culture and dynamic to be towards.
Right.
Federal power, the exercise of it, the use of the military on domestic soil. This is like a huge departure even from, you know, again, what I think the same actors in a different point in time were saying and doing, but also really from, like I said, the substrate that's like pretty apparent about, you know, hey, we love the military. We love the troops. Would they violate like my property rights? Maybe, if we let them.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know.
Well, the implication, I mean, that's one of the things, you know, like if we ask this in the future, we'll be watching. I mean, you know, we kind of know what was going on here.
Yeah.
Right? In terms of that, the tension between those impulses we've been talking about, you know, the sort of baseline impulses about federalism, states, state sovereignty in Texas, et cetera, where those boundaries are. And, you know, the increasingly powerful, impact of partisanship and hyper-partisanship and polarization. Because the minute you say, remember Barack Obama was president, you kind of go, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, this is an interesting circumstance.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping we'll see some Illinois state polling and we can, you know, we'll be able to, like, triangulate a little bit going forward as this goes on. And it's going to go on, I think. All right, so let's end by talking just a little bit about the U.S. Senate race. Again, we've talked about this a lot and talked a lot about, you know, cooling their jets, you know, while this race takes shape. Well, we've been saying that. Time has passed. We're now in October, and we are getting a little more information on the race.
I do feel like every time we say that, I can hear like a proverbial, you cool your jets.
Yeah, you cool your jets.
You cool your jets, sir.
That's good.
You know.
So, obviously, and there was no real point in doing a spoiler alert or making anything, but, you know, after lots of trial balloons and signaling in a very relatively unsurprising development, two-term Republican Congressman Wesley Hunt made it official and joined John Cornyn and Ken Paxton and some other lesser-known candidates in the GOP primary contest for the U.S. Senate seat that Cornyn is trying to win re-election to for the fifth time. I think there's something a little underestimated about that fact when people go, well, Cornyn, he's so weak and he's yesterday's candidate and all that, you know, all of which, you know, are plausibly or yesterday's Republican, whatever. But also, like, you know, this guy's fifth time.
Yeah, so, well, and also we've talked about this. You know, he usually kind of performs at or near the top of the ticket in most places when he's on the ballot in the general election. Now, that's not his problem.
Guy's known what he's doing so far.
Yeah, and that's not, and obviously that's not his problem, and that's not why the Republican primary is getting full.
Right.
But as you said, you know, this wasn't really like a surprise because Wesley Hunt's been like running statewide ads. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think back in the summer there was some like, well, you know, he's just making noise, kind of like Ronnie Jackson, and everybody's sending up predictable trial balloons. But certainly, as the summer ended and the fall began, it was pretty clear Wesley Hunt was not just – he wasn't going to be buying statewide ads just to check out the –
yeah, his were clearly strategic. Yeah. So we included him in our August poll and in our fave-unfave. So Hunt was viewed favorably by 22% of Republican voters, unfavorably by 10%, 17% were neutral, and, you know, a whopping 50% expressed no opinion, which, again, is not surprising. Like, we talk about this kind of stuff all the time. You know, there are some Congress people who, you know, rise above kind of their district in various ways. You know, that can be good or bad, honestly, depending on how they do it.
Well, more people have an opinion about Jasmine Crockett than Wesley Hunt.
Well, that's right. And, you know, more, but you know, but
just for one comparison.
But that's a great comparison because, you know what? And also more people have a negative opinion of Jasmine Crockett.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the way these things kind of tend to play out. You know, is you get more known, you're going to have more people like you and more people dislike you.
Yeah.
You know, for comparison, so we said 22% of Republican voters have a favorable view of Hunt here, 55% hold a favorable view of Paxton, 42% of John Cornyn. So that sort of gives you a sense of kind of where he's, I guess. You know, I'll say this. In the our you know colleague Darren Shaw version of this, you know, what you might do is you say, well, let's just take away everybody who's expressing no opinion and use that as like a sense.
Yeah.
You might say, oh, that puts him at about 44. So he's basically, you know, if you start taking away, right, you take away 50, then you
double
it.
Goes over well. He's gone over well with the people who know who he is.
Yeah, but I'd say
the
that,
Republicans
you know,
who know who he is.
And I'd say, you know, what that does is that puts him probably around where John Cornyn is in terms of favorability. You know, his unfavorability would also double from like 10 to 20. And that puts him a little lower than John Cornyn. And you say, okay, yeah, that seems about fair. You know, we'll see what happens and how that plays out, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing to note about that 50% who are expressing no opinion, and there's a few more neutral in there, I think, you know. There are all kinds of different views out there right now about, you know, from potential, you know, Paxton or Cornyn supporters about who he's going to draw, who Hunt might hurt the most. I mean, but if he draws anything, it increases the chance of a runoff. And I emphasize the 50% there because that does mean that he's got some space to try to define himself. Now, you know, the Cornyn campaign was out immediately trying to drive his negatives up.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, he's missed a bunch of votes and, you know, why is he abandoning a congressional seat we need to hold in what could be a tough year to do this? And, you know, I thought it was pretty weak tea, frankly, but, you know, it was pretty rote, I would say. But, you know, that remains to be seen. And I think, you know, there are good arguments for just saying who he's going to draw from. But I think it's, you know, this is where the campaign and what the rollout looks like in the first few weeks and what people's – how he messages is going to matter. But I'm not sure it matters that much, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, unless it's really lopsided, and I just don't think it's going to be really lopsided.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll see, but I don't know. You know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, the thing is, you know, Hunt is – I think this is his second term. Is that right? I think.
Yeah.
I mean, so he's a relatively new – entrant into the space, you know, and I think, you know, he certainly seems to have indicated, you know, I mean, kind of as everyone who's entered the space reasons. I mean, look, this is part of Cornyn's problem. I mean, you know, I think Hunt has indicated a Trumpier leaning in his pronouncements and his approach.
Yes.
And I think,
I mean, it's fair to say, look, the conventional wisdom for a while was that this was actually a move to probably siphon, especially voters who were MAGA inclined, but might have reservations about Paxton for various reasons.
And that's
sensible enough.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I'll say this, you know, even though Cornyn was quick to attack Hunt, I think, you know, for Cornyn, you're better off having some more people jump in this race who are going to spend money. Cause I think, you know, if you think about it, the theory of the case is that Cornyn has some weaknesses amongst the most conservative Republican voters.
Right.
So the idea that someone like Hunt is going to come in, you know, with a fundraising disadvantage, without, you know, the senatorial committee who already blasted him, you know, all these other things, you know, and this is just setting aside, I'm just going to set this aside, setting aside whether or not Trump puts his thumb on the scale in this race, which is a whole big question we'll just leave aside for now, because when it happens, it matters. But if it doesn't, if he decides, you know, this isn't clear, I don't want to be out there, you know, which is very likely, you know, it just doesn't seem to me that the logic for why these guys are jumping in the race then points to how someone like Hunt is going to draw, you know, honestly, he's going to make it a strategy to try to draw from, you know, Cornyn's support.
Yeah.
And anything that then sort of divides up that kind of right-wing dissident, you know, discomfort with Cornyn and stuff is probably, you know, is probably good for him. You know, again, I thought a lot of the quick takes is like, well, this is bad for Cornyn. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, I kind of got the impression early on, but going back to the summer, that Cornyn was like, yeah, come on, jump in, you know? I mean, like,
yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's
we can use some more MAGA guys in here for you guys to sort of make this tougher.
And look, this speaks to some of the things that we've been talking about in terms of polling this race. I mean, I think the quickness of people to go, yeah, this is terrible for Cornyn, you know, is a function of investing too much in the snapshots that we've had of this race to date.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of underlines the point I think we've been making about this. And even if you were polling Wesley Hunt earlier and whatever, I mean, it's all, again, free country more or less, at least for now. And people can do this the way they want to do it. But
yeah. It doesn't mean it's not information, but I think the point we're just making here, it's such a dynamic environment that you have to understand that this information, I think you're making this point, but I just want to make it like really explicit here. Like think about all, I mean, you know, and this is just us, this is a burr under our saddle.
Well, we made the point at some length, a couple of podcasts.
But this is going to be a short version of it, which is to say, if you've been looking at, you know, trial ballots between Cornyn and Paxton for the last 2 months, well, guess what? Doesn't mean anything. Because now this guy's in the race and he's got a bunch of money and he had a big splashy entrance and he's a congressperson and he's going to work. And you know what? Now you got these three guys in the race. Now people are making a different decision. And they're all going to spend millions and millions of dollars between now and that decision.
Right. And you know.
So like, you know.
And his interaction is going to interact, you know, to be overly, you know, it's going to interact with people's views of the 2-3 months ago or two months ago or a month ago for that matter. So
makes it more interesting. You know, hey, I'm down. It's more interesting.
Well, and look, I mean, I'm happy for this race to take more shape because I'm tired of going, we got, you know, like it's like every cycle, you know, you sit around going, look, we got to wait. We got, you know, there's going to be a lot more is going to happen. So I'm just as happy for things to start happening and, you know, to know a little more. And this is,
well, this is the time.
We've been waiting for the shoe to drop and it's just nice to have it dropped, frankly.
Yeah. And the thing is, and the other thing for you, all you out there like us who are watching all this stuff, you know, this is when like the other shoes start to drop because now these other seats open up, then you say, oh, well, who's running for that seat now?
Right.
And this is when like it actually gets a little bit more interesting beyond just this one race.
Yeah.
A lot of other stuff starts to open up when these things happen. So that's also what's kind of
And we're just getting into the more active, you know, I mean, it's after Labor Day.
December 11th, you know, is the filing deadline. We're
getting closer. And, you know, we're getting more, you know, as more people get in the race, we're getting a better sense of what the fundraising universe looks like. So there's a lot of attention to be paid to that. So, you know, overall, flag it. You know, we've got a little date on that. You can find that at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. If you go to our search tool, one of the bars is for names. And if you want to go and you can click the tags. You can click Wesley Hunt. You can click Ken Paxton. You can click John Cornyn. And you can kind of look at, scroll through their numbers and look at the tabs. And you can even go down and pick Republicans only or Republicans and Democrats or conservatives only. In other words, you can play with this a lot. And I urge you to do that. The tool's there for the using. And I think a lot of you'll find it useful. So with that, that's just all that's going on.
Just a couple things. I mean, we'll leave some other stuff aside, but that's
fine. There's other stuff that I almost added at the last minute, but I think we should get while the getting's good.
Yep.
We got some stuff to do anyway. So Josh, thanks for making it here. I know you got a lot on your plate right now. Thanks as always to our excellent production team in the Liberal Arts Development Studio audio department here at UT Austin. Thanks to you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. Thanks a lot, folks. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.